Thank you. Yep, very happy to be here. Today I'm going to discuss a little bit about two elasticity imaging projects that I have going on at the University of Canterbury, and talk about them in the context of model-based reconstructive elasticity image, or model-based reconstructive imaging, and the pros and cons of this approach towards image development. So let me just first give a definition. What do I consider to be model-based reconstructive elasticity imaging? Well, it's basically a three-step process, a three-step process. The first step is that we apply some form of elastic energy into the object that we want to image. In this case, we're taking piezoelectric actuators here and applying an elastic wave into a set of gelatin here, tissue-mimicking gelatin phantom. So this forms our energy input into the system, and then we image the response of the elastic system to this energy input. So this is just a sample of the resulting motion pattern in, again, a gelatin phantom as imaged by phase contrast gradient methods using the MRI. So this is just one example of the type of data that we could get, but the basic idea is that we put the energy in and we image the resulting motion. And then in the model-based reconstructive imaging, what we do from there is we model our system, model the energy that we're putting into our system, in our case mostly using finite element methods, and update our elastic property description of that model until we can match our calculated motions using our model and measured motions using whatever system we're using for measurement. Here I show some motions that we're measuring using a calibrated digital camera system, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But the sort of final step, the most important step, model your system and intelligently update your guess for the elasticity until your modeled measurements match your measured motions. That's enough M's for you. So why do we use this approach? Well, we use it because it's very powerful and allows us to use very sophisticated material models. I'll get into more detail on that. What are the major issues with this approach? Well, the first thing that most people who would say to you who work in this sort of optimization-based imaging field would tell you is that, you know, it's computationally intensive. Convergence can take a while, depending on how complicated your system is, how well-conditioned your system is. Model calculations can be quite significant in terms of the computational power required. Certainly if we're calculating at MR resolution, we can be looking at many, many gigabytes of RAM required for just the modeling itself. And this optimization process, this iterative optimization process, because of the nonlinear relationship between stiffness and motion, makes this nonlinear optimization process intense. That can require multiple calculations of this model to go through our multiple iterations, and we can be talking a long time for convergence. So what are some of the other techniques that people use to get around this shortcoming? So one thing that people can do is, one idea that people have had is, instead of trying to match measured motions to calculated motions, just input a pulse at some point in time and watch the propagation of that pulse through your object. And you'll note here that at some point the wave speed of that pulse increases, and that's related to the stiffness. Okay, the stiffness, the wave speed of a mechanical wave is not linearly related, but directly related to the stiffness of the tissue. If you know the density, which we usually do in tissue, then you can look at this wave speed and calculate and infer some stiffness information from that. You could say, well, wherever the wave was or the pulse was at this point, it was stiffer. Major issues with this. One very significant issue with this technique is it requires transient wave propagation information. So you actually have to model that wave front propagation through the tissue, and that can be either challenging, costly, or time-consuming, or all three of the above to achieve this transient wave propagation information. The problem definitely gets more complicated in heterogeneous media, and when you have reflections off of internal structures and boundaries, this time-of-flight problem can get certainly mathematically more involved. And the addition of extra dimensions will also make this problem more complicated. Other techniques that people use, and this one's certainly related to time of flight is the idea of just looking at wavelength, okay? So if I have a standing wave pattern in my sample now, the wavelength of that wave pattern will be related to the wave speed, and we know, you know, from the previous slide, the wave speed is also, again, related to the stiffness. So this increased wavelength in this region would indicate stiffer material, and you can compare that and get some sort of relative stiffness description from this region compared to this region. Okay, but again, showing you that in 1D, as soon as I add boundaries or something, the wave pattern, if I have reflections off of boundaries, gets a bit more complicated to interpret, and that's one of the major issues with measuring wavelength approach, is definitely the problem of measuring the wavelength, coming up with a number to define as a wavelength, gets more complicated in heterogeneous media. It also gets complicated when I have reflections from structures and boundaries. And again, the addition of extra dimensions makes it more challenging. Final technique that people use for imaging elasticity is you just say, well, I've measured some motions, okay, in the MR we can do this, we can measure motions in all three directions, and I can just take those measured motions and I can plug them into my model, okay? So I have a mathematical model that describes the motion inside an elastic media given some input or some forcing, and I can just plug those measured motions into this partial differential equation, and instead of considering a differential equation for U, I can solve instead for my stiffnesses. Well, the problem with that, obviously, is that my measurements of these motions will include some noise, and now all these motions appear inside these differential operators. And so as soon as we take this approach, we're trying to differentiate measured measurements, which include noise. We're getting introducing the explosive aspects of that problem, and so we require filtering methods to reduce the noise corruption in these type of solutions. So differentiation of noise and data requires filtering. As soon as I start filtering my data now so that I can take those required derivatives, I may be removing the evidence of small lesions. I mean, part of the idea of imaging elasticity is we might be trying to detect very small cancers. As soon as I start filtering out small perturbations in my motion data, I may be actually removing the evidence of the very lesions that we're looking for. So that's a danger of this technique. Another aspect of this technique is that the compressive wave term, just given here, becomes very troublesome in nearly incompressible media, which is what most tissue are. You usually have to get around this problem by taking the curl of your measured data, and then that just adds another level of differentiation onto your already troublesome problem. So all these techniques that people are looking at for doing this conversion of motion data into elasticity information in the tissue have problems. So the obvious question is, well, which method is best? And I would say that the obvious answer really should be, it depends on what you want to do. Some of these techniques are very fast and very rapid, almost real-time imaging of elasticity based on ultrasound or MR data. And if what you're going for is speed, then the computational intensiveness of these reconstructive imaging methods may not be what you're looking for. However, if what you're going for is accuracy or some other more sophisticated nuance that you want to achieve out of your data, then maybe you don't want to use filtering methods, maybe you don't want to use a method that requires some sort of a mathematical approximation at the boundaries, and you want to use something that's model-based. So I think, in general, the answer to what method should we use to reconstruct elasticity from motion data, many people have been trying to answer it for a while. I think the real answer is that over time we'll see solutions evolve for the particular problems that we're looking at, okay? So I do, my expertise is in, or I call it expertise, is in reconstructive elastography. And so I have two projects which make use specifically of the fact that we are doing reconstructive-based elastography. And I say that because both of the methods I'm looking at are only possible, really, using this reconstructive approach. So the first of these is I call digital image elastotomography, and this uses surface-based motion information to infer internal elastic structures. Here, because we don't have actual motion data where we're looking for stiffness values, we are required to reconstruct internal stiffness values. We don't have anything to differentiate. We don't have propagating wave fronts to look at their time of flight information. So we have to do a reconstructive elasticity problem in this case, in the diet case. This thing is ill. The other technique that I'm looking at, and I'll show you slides from both of these, is what I term, again, advanced magnetic resonance elastography. This uses data from the MR, which is interpretable in other ways, but what we are applying these more sophisticated material models, which actually are only possible to image if you can do a reconstructive imaging approach. So just diving right into this. So to start off with, I'll look at this digital image elastotomography project. We call it DIET as a short term. Here, again, we're taking internal elasticity images, but all we're using for data is surface-based motion measurements. And just to briefly acknowledge some of the many students who have worked on the project. So the concept in general is, and this, we're specifically targeting this for breast cancer applications. So the concept for the DIET project is you have the breast with some lesion inside of it. You apply some sort of actuation to the breast, okay, and that gets these motions, this elastic energy passing through the lesion with motion expressed on the surface. We then image this motion pattern on the surface using a set of calibrated digital cameras. We take the information from that and we plug this into some model-based reconstructive imaging algorithm, and we come up with an image of what the internal stiffness distribution in this tissue was, just based on the surface motion data captured by the camera system. So an example, just quickly, of some of the phantoms, initial phantoms we were using on this project. We're using silicon-based phantoms since we don't need strong MR signal. And we have an internal spherical hard inclusion, an internal cylindrical hard inclusion, and we have another binary phantom, which has just a hard and soft top and bottom. We also made a homogeneous phantom. Experimental setup, this is a very, very early experimental setup, shows some of a prototype in its full glory. Basically just using two off-the-shelf digital cameras, which we've calibrated using a special technique we developed, some strobe lighting, and this is an actuator which we built, which applies mechanical motion from the bottom in the up and down direction. And this is just a sample of some of the data that we recorded using the calibrated camera setup, and we've applied these fiducial markers to the surface of this phantom. And what we actually do in the imaging process at this point is we track these fiducial markers. Now, obviously, in breast applications, we'll have to track the surface of the breast, and we have methods for doing that as well. But for the phantom experiments, all we've used for this phantom reconstruction is just our tracked motion of these white dots here. I think there's 16 in total. And we've used that to try, and what we want to try and do is reconstruct the stiffness of this internal object. Yeah. Awesome. Great, thank you. Yeah. Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Okay, so to do this motion tracking, first we need to keep track of what the motions are. So each of those two cameras is for each one of those dots, is imaging those white dots as they move through a cycle of motion, and that gives us a pattern like this. So this is basically what the cameras see. This is the cameras cycle throughout, take images and cycles throughout the phase and capture these images of the dot locations as they move on the surface of the phantom. We then take that information and we put it through a calibration algorithm that we've worked out for the cameras. And so this is 2D information on each camera. Through our calibration coordinates that we have, we can convert those 2D images to a progression of the dot's location in space in a 3D fixed lab coordinate system. So this is just a very standard photogrammetry application to convert that data. And at the end of it, we're able to, it's a little hard to see in this video, but there are the white dots. This is from each of the camera images. The white original white dots on this phantom, we've superimposed a red dot, which is our tracked coordinate location for that dot in space. So the red here is our computed motion pattern, and you can see it nicely tracks the actual white measured motion. So then we need to convert these. So we have these motion trajectories that look like this in space. This is our measured motion pattern for one of these dots, and we need to convert that into something that our mathematical models can understand. So we go through this sort of adaptive ellipse fitting technique, where first we just make a sort of gross estimation to the ellipsoidal shape of this dot trajectory, and then we optimize from that initial estimate. And then again, we're going to be comparing these measured motions to a finite element calculation of the calculated motions. The problem is that the measured motions will in general occur in some coordinate space in our lab coordinate system that may not exactly lie on the surface of our mesh. We're going to calculate motions on our finite element mesh. Those motions will be available at these node locations. We need to compare them to these points located in 3D space in the lab coordinate. So we do a system here where we look at the normals of our finite element mesh, project those normals out from every node, and capture a location for this point relative to one of the elements in our surface elements in our finite element mesh, and project that point back onto the finite element mesh to have a best estimate for its location in finite element space. And then we do some finite element simulations. So we have we know the geometry of our phantoms before we image. We build a finite element mesh of that geometry. In this case, we were using linear tetrahedral meshes of 17,000 nodes, 92,000 elements. We applied the known actuation to that finite element problem. So we've controlled our actuation in this system very carefully so that we can apply a known boundary condition at the bottom here. And this is the result of those finite element calculations. So, yeah? Yes, we're not compressing, so there's nothing on the top. It's a free surface. Okay. The only surface that we're applying actuation to is on the bottom. But that's because it's a dynamic sinusoidal actuation, you get these. So there's energy propagating all the way through. Any inclusion in here will present its information, so long as it isn't damped out first, onto the surface. Okay? Yeah? Yep, I'll talk about that in a second. To answer you quickly, right now for this system, I'll talk in a bit about how, I mean, this is a very, very poorly conditioned inverse problem that we're attempting here. We're already asking a lot of our system, even just looking for stiffness. So for this method, we'd be happy just to see stiffness. When we talk about MR, that's a different story, and I'll get into that at the end of the talk. So this is a linear elastic model in here. There is a slight level of damping that we've added just because we're talking about sinusoidal actuation. It's a wave problem, but we've assumed that we can know the damping to some respect. So, yeah, to go into your question further, I mean, so we now have to discretize the stiffness of this object. We're saying there could be something in there, and we want to figure out what it is, and we want to also figure out where it is. The problem is if we just go through a bulk sort of open inverse problem and say, well, let me take my 2D space, let me just talk in 2D for this example. If I just take my 2D space and say, okay, well, I've got stiffnesses at each one of these nodes, and then maybe there's a hard object in here, maybe not, I have to allow each one of these nodes to be a degree of freedom for my problem, which is a lot of degrees of freedom. Yeah, I mean, you can actually easily see the relationship in that we're looking for stiffnesses at each one of these values, at each one of these internal points, and we're only getting measurements, in the best of cases, off of these surface points. So the relationship between how many unknowns and knowns we have is always going to be the relationship between the internal volume, which is our number of unknowns, and the external surface area, which is the number of knowns. So you're, no matter what you do, if you're using this approach, you're always ill-posed. So to get around that problem, we've moved towards a shape-based property distribution, where we define some shape functions to describe our property distribution and then look to optimize the descriptors for those shape-based functions. Okay, so in this case, we've said, all right, we're going to have something that looks like a sphere inside. We'll say that thing has a diameter. We'll say we don't know the inclusion. We don't know the elastic modulus in this object. We may not know the background modulus either, and we don't know the location of this sphere in this case. So this makes our problem easier, and that now we're just looking for these one, two, three, four, five parameters instead of trying to capture all these parameters. Okay, and that allows us to easily, by only changing a few of those parameters, change our description of the elastic modulus for this problem. So we, even with that, we still have a very poorly posed inverse problem. And just clipping through here, if I define my error functional as the difference between my measured and calculated motions, in this case, looking at the real and imaginary components because we assume there's some sort of damping, this is just my error function over some of these shape parameters, okay? So the inclusion diameter down here and the inclusion height up here. So this is even removing the unknown of how stiff is the inclusion. And if I just look through this space, I see that I have these local minima cropping up even in this fairly simplified search space, okay? All right, so I've already gone through that. So even using those shape-based functions, we're still fighting a hard battle. To get around that, we've moved to a hybrid optimization method, which composes of starting with a genetic algorithm, okay, with multiple guesses within that search space, refining, using this genetic algorithm to refine our initial guess for the reconstructive algorithm, and then feeding a bunch of best initial guesses, a selection of best initial guesses that we've developed from this genetic algorithm into a gradient descent-based algorithm, okay, which would always get trapped in these local minima. Now, at the end of this process, we'll still have a selection of solutions, but in general, the lowest of those solutions will correspond to the correct solution. In addition, we'll have a number of solutions congregating around the correct solution, and you can use statistics to differentiate out the incorrect solutions. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go through the details of exactly how this works. We do have a paper that's out on this and explains it in more detail. But the basic idea is you combine a genetic algorithm to develop your initial guesses and then refine that selection of initial guesses with gradient descent algorithms to quickly go and determine for each one of these initial guesses what's the lowest final error that I can get from this initial guess and look at a collection of those statistically to determine our correct solution. So in the end, our correct solutions are always statistical. So just quickly going through some results here, for this concentric phantom, again, here's the data we're measuring off these points. Here's what the motions look like. The actual data for this case was this, okay? So here's the data we're driving this inverse problem off of. It's just these motions here. Here's just a sample of those dots. Going into our hybrid reconstruction algorithm, here's the solution we're looking for, okay, based on external testing of what the Young's modulus was and the known geometry of our inclusion, i.e. So this is a cross-section from the center. So here's the center of this phantom. Here's the Young's modulus of that stiff inclusion, and then in the outer, here's the softer outer modulus. And so initial guess, if we just do one generation of a genetic algorithm, here's sort of what we wind up with at the end of that, where we have large variances on each one of our stiffness estimates. We have a general idea that there's something stiff in the middle, general idea something soft on the outside, but still not a very rewarding solution. If we increase the number of genetic algorithm generations we do, we start to get a better and better picture of what the distribution looks like. So kind of go back. Except now we're talking about 100 generations of genetic algorithm, which can, for a large problem, be significant computationally. So with this hybrid mechanism, if we take one generation of CEO and add 10 iterations of gradient descent afterwards, we can start to improve for smaller, for smaller number of generations of genetic algorithm, if we couple them with a short burst of gradient descent, we can get sort of a very nice description, actually, of what we're seeing inside this phantom. And then if we sort of increase the number of genetic algorithm generations that we use, you can see we can refine that solution even more. For the spherical phantom data, we observe same thing. So here's just a quick illustration. Again, this is all the data we're using. It's just the little motion patterns we're measuring at these points. And the reconstructions, after 10 iterations of genetic algorithm, this was the stiffness distribution that we were estimating. Again, there was some local minima that indicated a very large stiff object up towards the top of this phantom that was being favored by this number of genetic algorithm iterations. As we increased the number of genes that we used in our genetic algorithm, that improved until finally, when we used 100 genes in our genetic algorithm, we had this estimate for the stiffness distribution in that spherical phantom. And then furthermore, because we're doing a statistical process, we can also look at our sort of our deviation. You can think of this as our confidence. And you can see that, okay, so we indicated a stiff inclusion in the center here. Not only that, but we can see that we actually sort of have a relatively high confidence of that stiff inclusion. Okay, we have a high confidence in the background, somewhat lower, but still high confidence about the interior of this inclusion, some lower confidence around the boundary, and then there's the evidence of some object up here, which we're not quite sure about. So it's kind of nice having this statistical information as well. And then we can look at a homogeneous phantom. And the homogeneous phantom, because we didn't have any data off the top of this top surface of this experiment, it couldn't really deny that there might be something stiff right in this location. It's the same location we saw in the spherical phantom. And so there is some evidence of an increased stiffness in here in the homogeneous phantom. But in this case, you'll notice very little confidence that that's correct. Okay, so this standard deviation, this confidence information sort of indicates that, well, we're not too certain about that, which is, again, why it's nice to have. Okay, some new developments we're doing in here. I'm just going to rush through these quickly for the interest of time. But obviously, okay, so we're using a finite element mesh now. We're meshing the entire interior of this object. It requires quite a bit of discretization to do it on a very fine scale. So we've looked also at using boundary element methods, where if you take the finite element equations, you apply Green's theorem to them one more time, you can actually restrict yourself to a case where, so long as you have a known sort of fundamental solution for your partial differential equation, you can discretize your solution to be completely just boundary-generated integrals. And you can remove your discretization problem to one where you just have to discretize the surface of your object and the surface of any inclusions that you might have and come up with calculated motions. So these are boundary element solutions for the dynamic or time harmonic motions on a cylindrical cylinder and a sort of hemispherical object. Now, one nice thing about boundary elements is that the way you develop these integral equations that used to solve these problems, if you have an inclusion, if you want to move this inclusion around or regenerate this or change the stiffness value in this inclusion, you don't have to recalculate the integrals. Well, in many cases, you don't have to recalculate the integrals on the rest of the surface. So if we wanted to do a process where we, say, swept this inclusion location through our entire phantom, all it would require is rediscretizing and reintegrating the integrals on this surface alone, and we can leave the rest of this surface untouched. This makes it very fast to just sweep through the entire volume, estimating that there may be something stiff here. So this has led to a new look at the inverse problem in this case, where we literally take our data and then we just put an inclusion in a bunch of different spots. We can even change the stiffness of this inclusion and look to see, all right, where do we get the lowest error? And maybe that's a good starting place for a guess as to where there might be an inclusion. And we've seen in a study that we've just completed on this that, so this is just an example for a 2D case, that this is for a 3-millimeter inclusion which was located right here. This is the error function as we swept this inclusion solution, you know, generically swept an inclusion of a different size and stiffness. This is the error function that we get. We can see it nicely contains a minimum right where we want the inclusion to actually be. Now, if we move that inclusion to be too small, we get garbage out. And this is, now we've reached, you can see this motion error estimate 5e to the negative 8. we have to numerically evaluate the boundary integrals in this case, and the accuracy that we specify those boundary integrals to be evaluated to is of the order of 1 e to the negative 8, so we've now reached numerical noise, and we can't differentiate this inclusion size. But even a 3-millimeter inclusion, this is all, you know, in theory, numerically, we can detect it. Another thing we've looked at is those shape-based functions. Okay, so we're using these very simple sort of spheres moving in rectangles. Can we get a little bit more sophisticated than that? The answer is yes, we can. We can use these radial basis functions to define the interior shape of these inclusions, and this is just some quick work that was done on this. So in this case, we have an actual object in our domain, which is indicated by the red, and we start a radial basis function description of an object that's initially located at these pink dots. We iterate and we find the object. We see that these pink dots converge to the actual object location even with the addition of more noise. Okay, very nice. Nicely, these radial basis functions are flexible, so they allow this object, so even though this starts out as a sphere with the same number of points, we can define a kidney-shaped object. What's really nice about radial basis functions is they are an implicit description of the shape. Okay, so they're not explicitly one sphere. This shape function is defined by these point locations here and some surface normal information. As we update this, because it's an implicit description, that description actually changes into two objects. So in this case, we have initially the objects are these blue squares. There's two of them. We start from this initial guess of just a single sphere. We iterate for a little while, and you see that our single sphere actually splits up into two separate objects, nicely defining the location of those two objects there. So radial basis function description of our shapes works even in increased noise cases. And finally, I mentioned it just briefly, so well, no matter what, whether we're using boundary elements or finite elements, we're going to have a very, you know, a lot of the accuracy of this system will depend on the accuracy of our mathematical model of the system. Our point data now from our photogrammetry problem, now with our, you know, updated prototype, we're getting many, many more points, and we started looking at taking this point cloud information, so this is a point cloud, this is the raw data from our calibrated camera system, feeding it into an algorithm, again using actually using radial basis functions to sort of describe all these point locations by a clean set of functions. Feeding those functions then into a surface measure. Okay, we add a little bit of information assumed about the chest wall and where the actuator is, and then developing a surface mesh from that information, and then passing that surface mesh on to an automated volume measure. Okay, in the boundary element case, we could just stick with the surface mesh. For the volume elements, we pass that surface mesh information on to a volume measure, and we generate this fairly decent looking volume mesh of our object, all automated. Okay, so we take this is a completely automated process. We take the raw data off the camera system and pass it into a system of algorithms which wind up with this volume mesh. So we can generate patient-specific volume meshes for each one of these cases, which is important. Okay, now, so that's diet. And the reason why we're using model-based reconstruction in diet is because we don't have internal motion data to differentiate or look at wave speed or any of that, so we have to use a model-based reconstruction process. Now, I also have another research project looking at MR elastography. There are plenty of people looking at time of flight, motion differentiation, and MR elastography. And you can do MR elastography without model-based reconstruction. So why am I looking at model-based reconstruction? Well, what my idea for MR elastography is, MR elastography, all right, let me go back a bit, diet, very cheap, okay? All we're using to get our data are digital cameras. We run an inverse problem on them, and we have an idea of what the stiffness is. Okay, so with a set of digital cameras and a computer, I can tell you what the internal stiffness of your object is. So I don't need an MR to tell me internal stiffness. Okay, I could do it with cameras, I could do it with ultrasound, I can do it with a lot of things that are a lot cheaper than an MR. So why would I use an MR? Well, I think the main reason, and there are people who would disagree with me, and I welcome that, but in my mind, one of the main reasons for using MR is because you get such an incredibly strong data set with, you know, equal equal quality data in all three directions. You get so much information that we really ought to be able to develop quite advanced material property models for the tissue and use these for a diagnostic effect. Okay, so I think if we want to screen, if we want to do pre-screening, all of that can be dealt with ultrasound or diet or simpler methods. The MR, in my mind, the value of MR will rest in its value as a diagnostic aid in determining, is this hard object we see malignant, is it benign, is it a cyst, what is it? Okay, and so that involves using more advanced material property models, and some of these advanced material property models don't allow the use of simple wave speed based methods. Okay, so sorry, get, you know, half an hour into my talk and then drop all this mathematics on you. I just want to quickly go through. So the basic idea here, it's an optimization-based method. Again, we have some measured data. I'm going to call it Y. Some function of our stiffnesses. I'll call my stiffnesses or my material property description theta. I'm going to say that my final theta, my solution, is going to be that theta which minimizes the difference between my measured motions and my calculated motions. This is a nonlinear relationship between my stiffness and my motions. Therefore, I have to use some sort of iterative update optimization-based method to calculate this theta and do that using very standard approach here. This is just basically a Gauss-Newton method applied to this multidimensional problem. Might add a little bit of regularization to make this matrix inversion look all right. And for an f of theta, we'll start out initially just using linear elasticity, and I'll start sophisticating this model as we move on. Okay? Even with that simplification, in here there are some real tricky bits, specifically this matrix and the fact that I need to invert it. Okay? The MR provides a very data-rich environment. Okay? So we're calculating motions on MR resolution. If we think that we were looking at a 12-centimeter square volume covered with the standard MR resolution of, you know, 256 by 256 by 16 voxels, that already leads to something on the order of e to the 18 floating point operations just to update this matrix. Okay? That doesn't count the something on the order e to the 16 to 18 operations just to build this matrix. All right? So that's a lot of operations. If we just go at this at a brute force method and say, okay, let's just optimize this full volume here, we're talking lifetimes, even on today's computers, to solve this problem. So unfortunately, I mean, we've got a great problem set up here. We've got beautiful data. We've got it on a very high resolution, but we can't capitalize on this data without doing something about this issue with the number of operations that we're talking about. So the approach that I've developed as part of my PhD work was to take this problem and say, well, we have some sort of domain that we're trying to operate on, but I have motion data for this problem everywhere. I've just measured it using my MR. That data is very good, so I trust that data. I can actually repose this problem that I have on my global domain onto some smaller domain inside this space, which we call the subzone, which is basically, I just take the boundary of this domain and I capture my measured data on that point. Okay, so if this is my global domain here, I just grab some small zone of that. I can capture the boundary information from my measured data and drive a perfectly well-posed inverse problem on this subdomain as opposed to doing it on the global domain. And now I can resize the subdomain to be whatever fits on my computer. What's more, I could do this. Here I'm solving for this subdomain here. I could solve for this next subdomain on another computer, and so on and so forth. And this bulk level parallelization is ideal for distributed memory parallel processing because each one of these problems will take, you know, a couple seconds to compute, which is eons in computer speak. So even with like 10 gigabit network interconnect, a parallel problem here is actually fully scalable by the number of processors. So if it takes, you know, 10 hours to compute this problem on one processor. If I do it on five processors, it takes 10 divided by 5 number of hours. And that's for as many processors as you want. There's no bottleneck in communication. So, this is a little video of how this subdomain process actually works. And you can see, in this case, there was a soft inclusion in the center here. And you can see evidence of that soft inclusion cropping up on some of these subzones in the middle here, and I think eventually we get one that basically plops. You can see there's a little evidence of the soft inclusion, and right towards the end here, hold on. we get, I think there's a subzone which forms right on the soft inclusion. This is all done randomly. Yeah, there it is. You can see the soft inclusion in there. So the subzoning process is all done randomly. It's automated. You don't actually, visually, when you run the code, you don't know that it's solving on these subzones. You pass it the full volume information, you get a full volume solution back with a bunch of statistics on how this process went. But the basic idea seems to work. Some results we've had from this, this is just using a simple linear elasticity description of these phantom studies. So we had a phantom, we've added some MR contrast to two inclusions that we had in the phantom, a very small gap in here on the order of 5 millimeters, and this is what we got back for our elasticity distribution. And when we segmented based on elasticity versus on the MR signal, you can see that we did capture some of, but not all of, this little gap. So we were able to get somewhere around the 5 millimeter mark in terms of accuracy. My colleague Marvin Doyle has gone on and done a little bit of a study looking at how small can we go to detect inclusions and how small can we go to characterize those inclusions and for different levels of contrast, and seeing that if we're just talking about a detection problem, we can get all the way down to 5 millimeters and see that there's something hard there with a 5 millimeter diameter inclusion. If we want to actually characterize that accurately, i.e. say that that's a, you know, an inclusion with a modulus of this this many pascals, then we sort of are limited at 1 centimeter, okay? And that's for orders of, you know, almost or even above an order of magnitude contrast. But still, so we're capable of detecting and actually characterizing accurately very small inclusions. Just some clinical results. This is just using, again, linear elastic description. We can see that we can, even for a case where there's some fibroadenoma in this patient, we were able to detect that fibroadenoma and localize it compared to a healthy breast. Now, so all the linear elasticity stuff is basically, the objective is to say, well, this technique works. But like I said, the value with MR elastography is going to be in how sophisticated can we make these material models in order to get the most possible information of diagnostic value out of this image, because the image itself takes possibly three directions of, you know, we need motion information in all three directions. Each one of those images can be about a, you know, 10 to 15 minute spell on the MRI. If you figure one 10-minute MRI image costs about $1,500 American, you're talking about $4,500 image. So, you know, it's not a screening image. This is an image that you need when you really need it. And when you really need it that bad, you might as well get as much information as you can out of it. So, first thing I've looked at is what's called Rayleigh damping. Rayleigh damping is a method, it's a model for attenuation in an elastic material. That consists of a complex modulus, in the time harmonic case, so this is where we're applying motion that's time harmonic. In the time harmonic case, Rayleigh damping includes a complex modulus and also a complex density. Okay, so the complex modulus comes from the, whoa, so it's evident. All right, this is just relating, sorry, this is relating me. Stress is the time derivative of the stresses to the time derivative of the strains in the general form. So this is back into English down here. You can see if I have multiple time derivatives that I'm going to consider, then it's just going to say that there's going to be some sort of combination of moduli for each one of those time derivatives of the stresses, and the total of that sum will equal the total of a bunch of different factors multiplying the time derivative of the strains. Okay? If I do this time harmonic assumption over a number of frequencies, then I have this time harmonic expansion of this problem where I assume that all my emotions are time harmonic. Sorry. Okay, so this is all fairly standard viscoelastic theory. I don't want to get into too much detail. I just wanted to basically show that when you work through all that summation, you wind up with a sigma zero related to epsilon zero, my baseline strains and my baseline stresses. And it's all this factor, the sum of all these factors for the different frequencies we're considering. And this technically is my modulus now. It's a complex number because these are all complex factors, but this is the modulus that relates stress to strain in this viscoelastic time harmonic case. Okay, so this is well, most people are pretty comfortable with this idea that my modulus could be some complex number, and that that complex number, depending on the rheological model that I can use, I could differentiate what all these little constants are in here and come up with some rheological description. Now, what gets some people confused is, what is complex density? Sorry? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry, yeah, I've just thrown that out. I've thrown that out in the quick slide. Okay, so what is a complex density? Where does this idea come from? Well, if you think of just a, like, if you ask a physician, and by that I mean someone who's got a PhD in physics, to add damping to something, show them a dynamic equation with no damping, and said, put damping in here, a lot of times what they do is they just throw in some alpha times the first time derivative. Okay, there you go, damping. And if I then insert a time harmonic assumption into here, this e to the I omega t term, you see that this first time derivative here brings down this alpha, sorry, this is alpha bar here, alpha bar omega times u, I alpha bar omega times u, multiplying this other term. Here's the inertial forces, here's the viscoelastic, or the damping forces in this case. Now, if I just go back to my undamped equation, the standard linear elastic theory here, say it's undamped again, but insert a complex density, okay, where now my density is has just a complex component, so a real and imaginary component to my density, and put in the time harmonic assumption again, you see I get this exact same term, whoops, sorry, here it is, with I, rho I, oh, sorry, that was a little sloppy here, this omega should just be not squared, but a rho I omega multiplying u, which looks a lot like this I alpha bar omega multiplying u. So we can see that this, if I make this complex density assumption and compare it to this assumption where I've just added this damping term in here, that these are essentially exactly the same as so long as I consider that my complex or my imaginary component of density is just equal to this alpha bar over omega negative. You can also think about this, and this is probably a more traditional way of looking at it, Rayleigh damping. If I just take my now discretized solution and say that I have some damping matrix in here on my discretized dynamic solution, put in the time harmonic assumption, and just say that, and this is how people sort of originally discovered this Rayleigh damping, they just said, well, I'm just going to say that my damping matrix here is just some alpha times my mass matrix plus some beta times my stiffness matrix. Plug all that through, and you see that so long as that my real and imaginary components of my density and stiffness are related to these alpha and beta coefficients in this way, that these are equivalent. Okay, so I can use that last slide there just to come up with what's the overall damping ratio in a Rayleigh damped material, and it's related to these alpha and beta components, which are in turn related to the real and imaginary components of my elastic modulus and my density, so that my damping ratio now is equal to 1/2 of the opposite of my imaginary density over my real density plus my imaginary shear modulus over my real shear modulus. Okay, so this defines a damping ratio, which is how much attenuation actually is there in the tissue or in the object, whatever the elastic material is. We go, you can also, but there's more information now. Because we have this Rayleigh damped description, we can differentiate that damping that we have in terms of how much of it is due to a complex shear modulus effect and how much of it is due to a complex density effect. And that's the added bonus of this Rayleigh damping model. Okay, so we have, people have been able to image overall damping level in materials using MR elastography for some time. What we're adding is the ability to differentiate between what's the mechanism for that damping? Is it a complex shear modulus related mechanism or a complex density related mechanism? The obvious question here is, what does complex density mean? And to be honest, we don't know. It's something that we'll have to do a fair amount of experimenting to determine. My hunch is that because it's a damping mechanism that doesn't require any strain. So you have damping present in your material even if there is no strain in that location, because it's not in the equations, it's not multiplied by a spatial derivative, or it's not operated on by a spatial derivative. So that's a real dashpot sort of behavior. You know, that's fluid through some tight confining region is the same as you see in a dashpot. So it could be that the complex density component is related to some sort of porous media type effect or something. But I don't want to say too much about it because it's going to require experimentation to determine. Why do we have to do reconstructive imaging to image this? Well, if I'm using a wavelength or wave speed based reconstruction process, that has this differentiation of, that's the division of stiffness by density. Well, if both of these things are complex, if I'm just looking at the ratio of them, it's indeterminate where that complex component came from. So if both of the complex components of these are unknown, then the Rayleigh damping composition of this material is indeterminate from wave speed or wavelength alone. So you have to use a reconstructive elasticity approach. And so let me just go through some Rayleigh damping examples, reconstruction examples. First, just quickly, a phantom reconstruction that we have. This was not a phantom that was designed for damping experiments. So I don't know what the actual damping ratio of the inclusion was. There was an inclusion in here. It had some formaldehyde agar additive to it, so it would have different damping characteristics than the surrounding soft gelatin. Here's the reconstructed real shear modulus. Here's the thresholded MR image. So this is sort of the gold standard that we're looking for. Here's just a volume threshold of the reconstructed real shear modulus. You see very nice correlation. Again, here's the real shear modulus. There's two inclusions in here. So a slice through the lower, larger inclusion shows it very nicely. Slice through the harder upper inclusion shows, again, very nicely the inclusions. Very little artifact in these images, and these values actually match values measured by DMA. So we're fairly confident in the real shear modulus. Now, looking at the overall damping ratio in this phantom, again, we've added additives to this inclusion to make it stiffer, and those additives we expect would also increase the damping, and sure enough, inside this inclusion, we see an increase in the damping relative to the background. And interesting here, notice that this is, there are small artifacts, but this is fairly consistent that there is very little damping in the background and higher damping inside this inclusion. Now, here's a reconstructed Rayleigh composition for this phantom, and you can see in the background we have this very random pattern. Okay, this looks like just noise, and at first that might be troubling, except that no, there's hardly any damping in the background. So of course the nature of that damping is going to be it's not going to be a well-posed problem, right? This is a ratio of two things which should be almost zero. It's very hard to differentiate whether that's due to complex density or complex shear modulus because there's almost no damping to begin with. However, in the inclusion where we have heightened damping, we see now a much more convincing argument that yes, there is damping in here, and we expect it to be mostly due to, for some reason, complex density. Okay. Now this is where I start to want to ask more questions. I wish I had the slide to answer them. Is why is that complex density? What do we have to do to make that complex shear modulus? But we're working on those experiments now. Let me just show you some patients' results that we have from this method. These are again very preliminary. So this is just a normal high-resolution MR of the breast case. We've segmented out this volume information and passed this on to our reconstruction algorithm. This is the real shear modulus reconstruction that we have in this case. This woman actually did have a lesion in here. So this area of heightened stiffness in this location is correct in that there was, unfortunately, something wrong. But you can see some, distribution of stiffnesses in here with a localization of a lesion. What's interesting, though, is that you can also see characteristics of the actual internal structure here, this lob here, something about this structure here coming up in this Rayleigh composition image, also in the damping ratio image. There's aspects of the internal structure here which are expressed in both the Rayleigh composition and in the overall damping ratio in this tissue. And you see that right through the slices with this. In this case, we see regions over and over again, which sort of this region of heightened stiffness down where the inclusion was is again indicated in the Rayleigh composition. So I wish I could tell you what this means, but that's the next step for these methods. I mean, we're starting to look at material properties which are quite to sophisticated, and what their clinical significance is, we don't know yet, but this is what we'd like to start looking at with MR elastography. But you can see that there is some evidence that these new material properties may indicate some sort of tissue structure, some sort of tissue malignancy, so on and so forth. What's next? Next, we're currently working on, while we're getting these Rayleigh damping phantom experiments underway, next, in terms of the reconstruction algorithm, is to move towards anisotropic materials. Obviously, real tissue is anisotropic. We're looking at an orthotropic model, which just says that each direction can have a completely independent material property. I just wrote these up for fun. Here's the stiffness matrix for an orthotropic. We are always operating in nearly incompressible materials, so we have specially formulated our equations for near incompressibility. So here's the stiffness matrix for near incompressible orthotropic materials. Here's the constitutive matrix for near incompressible orthotropic materials, which includes this term, which is my favorite term I've ever included in any finite element code whatsoever. That's basically defining the relationship of the pressure to the volumetric strain in an orthotropic elasticity elastic material. And I don't have any inverse problems on this. I just quickly threw up some solutions of this. You can just see that as I increase the shear modulus in the different directions, you see the wavelength just increases in those corresponding directions, as you'd expect. So nothing terribly exciting. Another thing that we've looked at is using different basis functions. So all this MR elastography stuff today has been done on finite elements. You can use nodal-based basis functions. We've also looked at using higher-order element-based basis functions just to see if there's a benefit. So these are quadratic element basis functions. You can see when we're trying to reconstruct this stiff inclusion that there is this indication of stiffness, but these element basis functions allow curvature over the element, which is kind of interesting. They also happen to allow negative stiffness values, which is a bit of a problem. But when we look at sort of lower order element basis functions, again, here's this. This is an actual just T2 star MR image with a stiff inclusion in here, this triangular or cone-shaped stiff inclusion. Reconstructing this using our linear element basis functions, we see a nice indication of where that stiff inclusion is. And the nice thing here is that it takes much fewer unknowns to make this material description than it would have if we used nodal basis functions in this case. So this may be a way of speeding up the initial process of this optimization problem. Okay, almost through here. Conclusions. Well, reconstructive imaging is time-consuming and computationally intensive. That's the first comment I usually get when I present, and I don't argue with that comment. It can provide very accurate results that take into all relevant or known physical accounts effects that we can model. That's the advantage, all right? We can all these physical effects like reflections off the boundary and so on, we can include that in our model very easily. Then there are certain cases of imaging approaches out there that require reconstructive imaging. Other cases that don't require it, maybe we can add accuracy to your existing solution. So you do a time of flight based calculation, and then we go in and refine that by using a reconstructive imaging based approach. Nonlinear optimization is always problem specific, and in this case, there's still a lot to be learned. Okay, so we're just at the tip of the iceberg, basically, about how to best approach these problems. And I just want to acknowledge many thanks to the Fields Institute for having me here. Obviously, many students and postdocs have been involved in this work, and obviously funding helps. So thanks very much. And maybe a few quick questions.